From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The idea of public-private partnerships to spur innovation or promote public health is not controversial. Local and state governments and even the federal government often rely on relationships with private corporations to fund initiatives, making an implicit assumption that competitive pricing and efficiency will result in better outcomes. But a new book exposes the ugly downside of public-private partnerships. In entering into agreements with private companies, government institutions are often loath to hold accountable the very entities on which they depend and end up trading away the rights of real people. When the line between the private good and the public good is blurred, the public often pays the price. My guest is Jonathan H. Marks, director of the bioethics program at Penn State University and affiliate faculty in law and international affairs. He's also an academic member of Matrix Chambers, London and Geneva, a leading group of human rights lawyers. His TED Talk, In Praise of Conflict, has over a million views and was the basis for his new book, The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this idea that we should enter into partnerships with private companies as not necessarily being a good idea, I feel, came into view quite starkly with the recent crashes of the Boeing aircraft, the MAX 8 aircraft, where we have now found out after two planes have crashed within 6 months that the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, that government agency that is supposed to be protecting the public good, had essentially turned over regulation and oversight of its aircraft to the very manufacturers. Do you see this as an example of exactly the kind of thing you write about in your book and why these PPPs are not a very good idea?
So the examples I raise in the book are to do with the food and soda industry, and actually I also talk about the opioid industries, cases in which public health is at stake. The example you cite is one, of course, in which public safety as well as public health is at stake. And I think it's part and parcel of a larger picture, which of which public-private partnerships are a major part. But the idea is that we rely more heavily on the private sector, including collaborating with the private sector, and that we step away from regulating the private sector. And I think the 737 MAX example you gave illustrates fundamentally why we need regulation and why there should be distance between government and industry. And, you know, I argue in the book, it's not as though government is inherently good and industry is inherently evil. Nothing of the sort. Each is capable of good or ill, as current politics often remind us. But there's important reasons for distance. The government can't do its job of regulating industry if it also happens to be partnering or in bed with industry.
Let's talk about that aspect of it, that there is supposed to be a tension between the government, which represents the public, and industry, which represents private interests and profits, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have created corporations in order to generate a profit. They depend for their existence on generating a profit by selling goods or services. But the job of government agencies is to protect the public good and public health. And, you know, my view is if a corporation and the executives of a corporation are not complaining about the regulators, you have to worry about whether the regulators are doing their job. As you say, that is the whole point. They should be in a relationship of tension and at times direct conflict.
We seem to live at a time where that line is incredibly blurred. And I'm wondering why you think that has happened. Why do we have government officials touting the benefits of partnerships with private corporations and giving us the sense that it's superior? For example, I mean, the healthcare debate in the United States today is rife with this kind of thinking that private health insurance companies, we are told, are the most efficient efficient way to deliver healthcare and that our government-run system would simply be too bureaucratic and too inefficient. We should be relying on these private corporations. How has that come about to be this way?
Well, the first thing just to say, of course, is that claim, as you and I both know, is totally untrue. If you look at publicly administered healthcare systems, their administrative costs are in the single figures, often low single figures, whereas the administrative costs of systems like the one we have in the U.S., and actually there is none quite like the one we have in the U.S., you know, estimates of the administrative costs of that system range from 16 to 30-something percent, so huge percentages of our health insurance and healthcare costs are administrative. So that's the first thing. And second, that you ask, how come the popularity more broadly of the partnership model? Well, I think often public health agencies are strapped for cash. They need money. And corporations are more than willing to provide that money because it gives them opportunities to burnish their reputation and to purchase influence. You know, the corporations totally understandably develop strategies of influence involving government agencies, regulators, public health agencies, the academy, public health NGOs, and all the rest of it. And we should totally recognize that they will try to do so to the full extent that the law permits. But these other entities have an obligation to insulate themselves from industry. And that includes government agencies, public health agencies, who often run into the arms of industry to take the money, when instead they should be standing back and asking themselves some very difficult questions first.
Let's focus on some of the examples that you have in your book. You mentioned the opioid crisis. How does that incredibly broad public health crisis that has taken so many lives, how is that an example of how public-private partnerships have failed the public?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, the opioid industry, like the pharmaceutical industry more broadly, has engaged in all kinds of partnerships. Senator McCaskill and her team produced a Senate committee report a year or two ago in which they described how not just Purdue Pharma, the makers of OxyContin, but a whole host of opioid manufacturers had given a huge amount of money to a number of health professional organizations, pain management associations, and the like. And when I say a huge amount of money, I don't mean from Purdue's point of view, which has billions of dollars of revenues and profits.
Purdue Pharmaceuticals, yeah.
Yes, but it was a drop in the ocean from their point of view. But it was a lot of money, you know, a million here, a few hundred thousand there. That's a lot of money for a patient advocacy group or a pain management organization. And what these organizations did is they generated their own guidelines, seeking to relax constraints on opioid prescribing. When the CDC tried to create regulations to tighten up on opioid prescribing, these organizations that received industry money lobbied against the tightening of those regulations. And we also saw academic institutions, for example. There's a piece in Stat News just this week about Tufts and the money it took from pharmaceutical companies that were selling opioids. They gave platforms to members of the leadership, CEO and the like, as adjunct professors to come and talk about the drug and to downplay the risks of abuse and addiction. So what these partnerships, what these relationships did is they took organizations and entities that were grappling with a public health problem, pain management, but they got them onto to sing from their songbook. And their songbook was, opioids shouldn't just be used for terminal cancer pain. It should be used for acute and other forms of chronic pain. And the risks of abuse, while they're not as great as anticipated, and the risks of addiction are not as great, that's the story they told, that's the song they sang. And now we have an epidemic which takes 130 American lives a day and costs, according to the White House's Council of Economic Advisors, more than $500 billion a year in terms of social and economic costs alone.
So when these sorts of issues are raised to government officials, given that government is supposed to protect public health, you often, you know, hear the response that, well, the system will work, there will be some sort of accountability, the corporation may be fined, and then they go about doing their business. But these fines, these penalties that corporations are slapped with, are they just sort of, superficial? I mean, aren't they just included in the cost of doing business for these corporations? And once more, greenlit to continue until they're basically stopped. We have that the sort of this idea of do no harm is completely turned over on its head. The corporations are allowed to harm us till they have to pay a minimal fine that they can just write off as a cost of doing business, and then continue and keep pushing the envelope because government just doesn't hold them accountable enough.
So it's certainly the case that the penalties as a percentage of the profits and the revenues are tiny. Again, in Senator McCaskill's report, she looked at the percentage of profits that constituted the fines that went to the opioid distributors, who were distributing huge amounts of opioids to pill mills and little villages all across places like West Virginia. And again, 0.0-something% if you think about the fine in terms of the profits and revenues. So yes, they are small. And then what happens is the corporations that created or exacerbated the public health problem are rewarded by being invited round the table again to try and solve the problems they created. So in 2017, when the NIH launched a partnership to address the opioid epidemic, it invited Purdue Pharma and a number of other pharmaceutical companies around the table. And Purdue, as you know, was pleaded guilty in 2007 to downplaying the risks of abuse and addiction. And then, according to recent court filings in Massachusetts, continued that aggressive marketing strategy for another decade. Physicians, when they met with drug reps from Purdue in Massachusetts, according to these court filings, were 10 times more likely to subsequently have prescribed Purdue's drugs to patients who later died of an overdose than physicians who prescribed opioids without meeting the drug reps. That's hugely problematic. And the NIH's position now appears to be, okay, we won't partner with companies that are on the receiving end of litigation like Purdue is now, but we still want to enter into relationships, they appear to be saying. We won't take money, but we will take, other things like drugs, gifts in kind, is what it's often called. And what I'm arguing is that still allows for influence. And more importantly, if you partner with drug companies to solve the opioid crisis, you're just going to get more drugs. If we really want to tackle the opioid epidemic, we have to look at all possible solutions to pain management, not just pharmaceuticals, and all possible solutions to the opioid epidemic as a social problem too.
It seems as though our government officials feel that corporations have some sort of inherent God-given right to profits at the expense of our health. And unfortunately, we have this contagion that has infected the government, infected at least the Republican Party and even some parts of the Democratic Party. Because if you do bring up that corporations should inherently not be trusted, that there should be this inherent tension between government and corporations, you're just labeled a socialist, right? That if you, that means you're relying on the government to do everything, and government is bad, corporations are good.
So that is the opposite of the Manichaean view that I was avoiding expressing at the beginning. And it's a ridiculous Manichaean view too. Neither is good nor ill. Corporations have been generated to make profits, sure. Let them engage in that activity. But the role of government is to protect the public good, including public health, and that inevitably involves regulating the corporate sector. Look, when the Boeing incident happened that you mentioned at the beginning, the CEO called up the president and said, "We have every confidence in our airplane," which, by the way, was, in my view, not a wise thing to do. But one should expect the CEO of a corporation like that to try and make the case, whatever case he or she can. But it's the job of government to say, it doesn't matter what confidence you have in the plane, Mr. CEO. The question is, what confidence do we as regulatory agencies and the public have? And it is our job as regulatory agencies to make sure the public's confidence, when it has it, is warranted.
So essentially, we have corporations being brought to the table and their representatives being brought to the table. We hear that kind of ideology of, or that kind of terminology often, when the public's health and safety is at stake, and they're brought in as partners rather than being seen as outside separate entities whose allegiance is first and foremost by design to their profits. What about the, I don't know if you've explored this in your book, but it seems as though one of the big reasons why government officials and agency heads and presidents and lawmakers tend to want to trust corporations is because that trust has sort of been bought and paid for through campaign contributions, right? They are reliant not just on corporations to make the funding available for underfunded projects, but also for their own re-election campaigns.
So, absolutely. And what I say in the book, of course, is that the partnership paradigm is one part of a larger systemic problem. And that is, of course, that corporations seek to exercise influence in a variety of ways. One, as you say, is campaign contributions. Another is lobbying. Another is the revolving door. There are some people whose CVs look like this: the FDA, Monsanto, the FDA, Monsanto. And you see that across a whole host of industries.
Our acting
So when I
defense secretary and Boeing,
So,
Patrick
indeed.
Shanahan.
So what I argue is, look, corporations have these complex strategies of influence. Government agencies need complex strategies, comprehensive strategies to insulate themselves from influence. And that means more than just conflicts of interest policies, which are obviously important. It means a whole suite of measures designed to address this systemic problem.
This idea that corporations, when they thrive, the public thrives, is also an insidious part, I feel, of the supremacy of corporations in our lives. President Trump has said, and so many others, not just him, feel that any regulatory framework that stifles a corporation's ability to make profits will have such a ripple effect over our entire economy that all of us will be impacted, and therefore we cannot have regulations that stifle profits. We must unfetter corporations to maximize their profits because the public will benefit. How do you respond to that?
So I have a whole chapter in the book on the common good. And what's problematic, I think, about the concept of the common good is it often leads, mistakenly in my view, to this assumption that what's good for corporations is good for everyone. Now, it is certainly true that if corporations in some regions, think of the motor vehicle industry in its heyday in Detroit and all the rest of it, if it was employing a large number of Americans, it's true that it was contributing to the community. So obviously corporations can contribute by providing viable employment at a decent wage, etc. But you cannot and should not discount the way in which a corporation's activities can also cause profound harm. It is absolutely the case that the pharmaceutical industry, in the case of Purdue, reimbursed a number of people very handsomely for their work as sales reps promoting opioids to physicians. But I just told you the evidence suggests the physicians who met with those reps were 10 times more likely to have prescribed opioids to people who subsequently died from an overdose. So do we really think that it's more important to keep the profit schedule of those reps at the expense of human life? I think not. Obviously, there are other ways in which those reps can contribute meaningfully in not promoting opioids to physicians. So I do think we need to think about regulating industry. And I think the argument that because industry contributes to the public good or the common good in some ways, it doesn't follow from that that it should get to determine what's in our public good, nor does it follow that we should partner with them to promote the public good. And let me just add one thing. When you partner with industry to promote public health or anything else, you essentially put off the table any measures that might truly promote public health if they're threatening or perceived as threatening to the commercial bottom line of those corporate partners.
Right, suddenly you are essentially strapped by that partnership. And the other aspect that doesn't often enough get raised, I feel, is that the public contributes to corporate health. Corporations take huge advantage of public subsidies, of publicly funded infrastructure, of public investments in their research that generates profits. So you don't hear the flip side of who benefits whom and who is owed whom. And unfortunately, we just seem to have this situation where we are subservient to corporations. And I'm wondering, finally, if you think that there are other countries or communities that have a healthier government-corporate relationship. It seems convenient sitting here in the U.S. to look at Canada and the European Union with a little bit of jealousy, because it seems as though those communities, those regions, have stronger regulations, have less reliance on corporations, and have a greater or just have stronger protections of the public health. There are stronger public health standards for things like, you know, chemical preservatives and other things. But is that just overly optimistic?
It's slightly optimistic. I don't want to disappoint you too much. It is true, of course, that in Europe there is, for example, the REACH regime, which requires manufacturers to now test products that are chemicals that are in our lives for their endocrine and carcinogenic disrupting effects. But that doesn't mean partnerships don't exist in Europe and other places and other parts of North America too. I'm sad to say that the public-private partnership paradigm is popular in many other countries across the world. And I have examples in the book from India, from the US, the UK, Malaysia, Brazil, just to name a few. So this is, in this respect, it's a global problem. I certainly think there are other countries that regulate industries far better than we do in the US, where they are totally understanding that regulations promote and protect public health. But the partnership paradigm, alas, is globally popular.
Well, not unless your book gets a broader distribution to warn us of these of the perils of these sorts of partnership. Jonathan, is there a website that you'd like to give out where people can find out more about your work?
They certainly can. My website is jonathanhmarks.org, JonathanHmarks.org. And I also tweet at Ethics Law Policy.
That's Ethics Law Policy on Twitter. We'll link to both of those from our website. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Jonathan H. Marks, Director of the Bioethics Program at Penn State University, an affiliate faculty in Law and International Affairs. He's also an academic member of Matrix Chambers, London and Geneva, which is a leading group of human rights lawyers. His TED Talk, which we'll also link to, is called In Praise of Conflict and has over a million views. It was the basis for the book that we've been discussing, The Perils of Partnership, Industry Influence, Institutional Integrity, and Public Health. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.